Welcome everybody to this forum. My name is David Wee. I'm one of the summer teaching staff coordinators, and I'll be the moderator tonight for this forum. Our topic for tonight is communities. For many of us, Holden is our first experience with this exact kind of intentional community. And for others of us, it's not. That there are other kinds of communities in the world, all over the world, historically and at present, that bear some characteristics that Holden shares and others that are quite remarkably different. And our panelists tonight are people who have experienced not only Holden, but other communities as well. And what we're going to do is have each panelist take 5 or 6 minutes to say something about themselves and what experience they've had with other communities, and then some angle on that, and then we'll open it up to discussion of the whole group. Those of you who've been at Holden forums before know that no matter what the topic, we encourage everybody to participate. Everyone is welcome to be a part of it. The one rule we have is that we listen with respect to each other, even if we disagree sharply or think somebody else is wrong. We listen with respect, we disagree with respect, and try to have a good and stimulating time. The four people who are with us tonight are Ann Hafton, Ann Reynolds Feldman, and Emily Kirsten Grip, and Frank Monzo. And I'll let each of them say a little bit more about themselves as we proceed. So Ann, would you start?
Sure.
I think I was asked to participate in this because I have spent a good deal of time working on a kibbutz in Israel. If you're familiar with the kibbutz at all, I'll just so you understand what it is, it's a collective farm, a socialist community of people living voluntarily in a cooperative setting. In Israel proper, my kibbutz was located just west of Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and the sea and the foothills of the Judean hills. But it's important to point out that I went to Israel and to the kibbutz from Holden. I had already been here and spent 6 months living in this community setting. And while I had a long-term interest in the Middle East and in Israel in particular, it was out of my experience here at Holden and this community that I wanted to pursue other forms of community and look at the way other people put themselves together into communities. And I met some people here who worked on this particular kibbutz, so I had a natural connection. And I traveled there several years after my time here at Holden and settled in to live 6 months there as a volunteer. So I had kind of parallels at work. I was a volunteer here, and at the kibbutz I was also a volunteer. But within a few weeks, some real striking differences began to make themselves apparent. And it's hard for me to talk about the kibbutz without comparing it to Holden, because that's what I was doing the whole time that I was there. Whereas Holden is a community that's really rooted in theology and expresses itself in worship, the kibbutz is a community that is rooted in ideological motivation and expresses itself through work. It's a highly labor-based community, and your respect and your achievements are all basically through work. You're regarded as a good worker or a slacker. Those are kind of the two ways that you could be looked at. I was living with a number of other volunteers. The volunteer staff wasn't as big as here, but it was really varied internationally. There were about probably at most 30 volunteers in a community of about 450 people. And we were from the US, Canada, Switzerland, the Scandinavian countries, New Zealand, Australia, and South Africa. And so that was my primary community, was other volunteers, but we also were each assigned a foster family or a adopted family, kind of grandparent figures who looked after us and helped us become acquainted with the rest of the larger kibbutz community. And that was our access point, was through our family. About a third of the people on my kibbutz spoke English, so those were the people that I had access to. The kibbutz where I worked is called Kibbutz Kfar Menachem. Is made up, it's about a membership of about 630. Membership originating 50 years ago, 52 years ago now, in Poland and Germany and Canada. And the kibbutz movement brought these disparate groups of immigrants together. They didn't have any say about who they would, they couldn't say, well, we're Canadians, we want to be with this other bunch of Canadians. The movement, the organizing force behind the establishment of all the kibbutz farms in Israel just assigned this bunch of pioneers to each other. They didn't necessarily even like each other. They didn't speak the same language. And they all had to learn Hebrew. That was their one commonality. And 50 years later, many of them are still living together. Young people that went to Israel as 18, 19-year-olds are still living on the same farm together. The difference, I think, that one of the differences is that I don't think one thing that's happened there would happen here. Some of those people don't speak to each other. They're not friends. They got mad at each other 30 years ago or something. It's an extreme example, but it does point to a factor that exists in a Christian community that doesn't exist on the kibbutz, and that's this factor of reconciliation and forgiveness. There just isn't any. They continue to live and work together. They continue to be committed to the same cause. They're still building the state of Israel in their point of view. They are committed socialists, but they don't necessarily have to be in relationship with one another. And I think that was the most striking difference to me, because a Christian community is only really exists to be in relationship to one another, in a reconciling and forgiving relationship that's based in Jesus. So these folks have built a country. Really, the kibbutz movement fed the early state of Israel, and they came with a very strong motivation, and that's what kept them going. They lived under very extreme circumstances. They now have a museum to show what it was like 50 years ago, and they had these little shacks and the big fences. They were living in fear a lot of the time, and whatever, you know, you can question the right or wrongness of their motivations, but they built a community for themselves that is now looks like a lovely, like a very lovely and quaint kind of old suburb out of these little tin sheds. And they built a state at the same time. They had a very, very strong motivation, and they worked toward that motivation for year after year after year. One of the problems that exists for them now is that they're an aging population. Most of the pioneers, the people that I first got to know when I went and lived there, are now in their middle 70s. And their children are the first generation of young people, the children of that generation, are in their middle 40s, and they haven't all stayed on the farm. Many of them have left. And more young people leave. More leave than stay. And so the community is aging and aging and trying to adapt itself so that young people will want to stay, and the more they adapt, the more they depart from their principles of socialism. So that there's a fear among the older community members that they will soon cease to have any ideological base at all. They will just be a housing development. I mean, they'll just be a town like any other that has capitalism at work. the principles of socialism have really been lived out there pretty purely, communism, really, for 50 years. Those people do not have private property. They don't make private incomes. They don't have homes other than the size that they need. And only in the past 6 or 7 years have children lived at home with their parents. And now that, just one incidental thing that's happening on the kibbutz movement is more and more and more, hardly any kibbutz anymore has their children living in children's houses the way they used to. Now they live at home with their families. One of the things this means is everyone has a different size house because people with bigger families need bigger houses. And when I first went to the kibbutz, everyone had the same size house because everyone had the same size family. Everyone had a very modest living room, a small bedroom, a kitchenette. That was it. And it was satisfactory. It was satisfactory for 40 years. And the other radical, another radical thing that happened shortly after the first time I was at the kibbutz is they got television sets. It was a very, very profound change. They formerly had had TV sets located in, well, frankly, in bomb shelters, in different parts of the physical plant. And if you wanted to watch TV, there were only two channels anyway, so how much could you fight about what to watch? You'd go to a central place and watch TV together. And people were out in the evening, walking around, walking from one place, or visiting. People visited, they'd go to someone's home and listen to music. They'd put a record on or listen to the Philharmonic from the city being broadcast on the radio. This is what people did together. Television came, it isolated everyone into their own little homes. And then the thing that happened last year, which was really extreme to me, everyone got their own telephone. Formerly, if you wanted to make a phone call, you had to go to the business office and stand in line, even up until about 4 years ago. This was how people made phone calls. Well, it was great, you hardly made any. But now everyone calls each other. No one goes out and walks around to talk to one another. Well, I've gone too long, but...
Okay, thanks. Frank, will you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Yes, I will. I experienced the kibbutz also, very much as Anne has, but this was in 1974, so up until 4 years ago I experienced very much the same thing, if not exactly the same thing. But when I began looking for a community, of course at that time I was a Catholic, and of course everything up to that led to why I wanted a community, and I was unhappy with what I had experienced at that time. I came out of high school, I had worked for General Motors. I started in a mail room and went to the service, came back, and I was in the accounting department at the General Motors Technical Center, and that was not a happy experience. And then I was selling, and I was a rep for Jockey Menzer at the time, and at that point they had cut my territory several times, and the last time my boss told me he was cutting it again, it's effective January the 3rd of 1970, I said, Buck, if you do that, I'm quitting. This is November the 22nd of 69. I said, Buck, you cut my territory, I quit. He said, it's cut. I said, effective the 3rd of January. I said, well, I quit. Effective the 3rd of January. And he says, well, he said, I ought to fire you right now. He said, but you can stay until the 3rd. There were reasons for that. So at that point, I said, what am I going to do? I didn't know what I wanted to do. I know I didn't want to go back to work doing the kinds of things I was doing for money and things. So I started thinking about it. I didn't know what to do, so I enrolled at the college. I didn't want to go to college. I had no intention. I wasn't a good student. I was a very poor student. But I did. I'm glad I did. And I graduated 3 years later, December 72, from the University of Michigan. And coming up to that, I knew I was going to have a problem, because I didn't want to do what I was doing, and I began to consider, and as the semesters passed, I said, Frank, what are you going to do? You know, where are you going? And I didn't know where I was going. So that fall, around the summer of 72, suddenly it began to occur to me, well, how about the religious life? And at that time I was a Catholic. So I was beginning to give it serious consideration, and I announced to my brother-in-law is from Rome. And he says, Frank, he says, there's something missing in those people. And I remember that, and I remember it to this day. And I couldn't answer that. So at that point, I went to the Newman Center on campus, and I talked to the priest there, and he knew the vocational director in the Archdiocese of Detroit. So I went down there, and this priest was a La Salette. Now, are you familiar with the difference between communities and diocesan religious and different religious? Should I just give a brief? You know, you take vows. As a religious, you take vows. Poverty, chastity, and obedience. Diocesan take chastity and obedience. Okay, now, when I went to see this La Salette father, he was the vocation director. He had set up interviews with me with the brothers, the Holy Cross Brothers, which were the Notre Dame Irish, the Fighting Irish. Those were the very first that I met. When I went to meet him, I went to Boysville of Michigan, which was a delinquent boys camp. It was an open camp. And that was my first introduction. Now, in doing all this, I had certain expectations, very definite expectations, because I have the Bible. And from that, there are certain things that our Christians are supposed to do, and certain type of, I would say, attitude, which would predispose a disposition, I suppose. And that's what I was looking for. Well, in 1972, this was 9 years after Vatican II, and at that time there was quite a revolution in what was going on in the Catholic Church. At that point, I'm still a neophyte as far as what my expectations are. And expectation is a very important point of what I expect and what is really there. Because what is really there is quite different from what I expected. Now, I'm going back and forth there, I understand, but they go hand in hand. Because when I got there, it was nothing like I had expected. A lot of these people were not very nice at all. Anne was speaking that they wouldn't speak to each other. They wouldn't speak to each other. Believe me, they wouldn't speak to each other. And it was more than, and often it was more than a quarrel. It was a fight. Not fist fight, but you know, it was bitter fights. And I was really quite disillusioned. I think David said, you were disillusioned. I said, no, grand disappointment. But I think probably disillusionment is accurate. So each, with the brothers, the Holy Cross brothers, at that point I met some ladies from who were Jewish and who were from that area and around Detroit. And he said, Frank, why don't you go and volunteer in the kibbutz? And I did. And I did go and I visited the kibbutz. Now, we're talking about communities and intentional communities with expectations themselves. There are certain things that they want to do, they have in common. And we may call that a focus. And I think it's important that we understand what that focus is for that particular community. I went there after I finished with my commitment there. I went back to the States, and again, I pursued this religious thing. Again, disappointed. Each time, I said, well, I'll try someone out, another community, because over there, it won't be different. For example, when you had a community, a Catholic community of priests and brothers, there is a difference. The priests, the brothers are not ordained, and priests are mainly, that's the difference. Well, in many of these communities, the brothers were there to serve the priests, you see, and they expected that. Well, I'm not one that takes to that very well. So there are going to be problems. You know? So in a case like that, I can say, well, if I go to a community that is solely brothers and nothing else but brothers, that problem won't exist. And I did that. But you get to one of those, and they put the novices in another room, and you're supposed to serve the ones who are already in vows. Well, I'm not going to take to that too well either, you see. So in the whole process of this, there's always something that I could always say, well, someplace else it will be better. Well, it's not going to work out. It's not going to happen. I think like the Italians say, tutto il mondo è un paese, which means, you know, the whole world is a small nation. It's true. It's foolishness. It's foolishness on my part to even think it was possible. But you see, I'm a hardhead. I insist. There is some place like that. And I continue to pursue this thing in that way. And I say, no, there is. Well, I became an Irish Christian, brothers. And I even taught here in Seattle at Old Bay High School. And I got to the point of just shortly before Christmas, and you're not going to may not like this, but I said, Frank, what are these people doing here? And I said, they're hiding. And I said, Frank, what are you doing here? I said, you're hiding. Well, I can't live a lie when I realize I'm living a lie. And I did leave. There's more to the story than that. But again, I'm a hard hit. Three years later, I began pursuing this thing again, up until the present day. On my trip from here, I traveled east from Minnesota south, and I went to Georgia specifically to visit a community. And at this point, I'm saying to myself, I don't want to join a community that has a creed, a philosophy, because from my experience between one community and another, when we talk about creeds and philosophies, that's a prelude to conflict. And I don't want conflicts. That's not my point. That's not what I read in the Bible. And I'm saying to myself, there's something really amiss here, because this is not what it's supposed to be about. And I haven't found it ideal. You know, and so I went to Georgia, and I visited a community there. And this was an intentional community, non-denominational, and without a creed and or a philosophy. Remarkable similarities between these communities. That one, for example, and other ones that I had been to, for example, would have, they distribute two, when you take a vow of poverty, it's pretty much poverty, but for example, that community in Georgia said they got $40 a month for pocket money, which was exactly the same as I got as an Irish Christian brother, which was very much the same as almost any other intentional community that I had visited. You're talking about between $20 and $40, but of course you have your food paid for, you have your medical expenses taken care of, you have everything taken care of. Remarkable similarities. The work ethic is remarkable, even as far as going back to the kibbutz in Israel, you know, you have very much the same thing. But of course in Israel, there was a conflict between the South American Jews and the European Jews, and they're supposed to put all their assets together. Well, the South Americans didn't, you know, and there was quite a conflict between the Europeans who came there quite poor. But we're talking about the same thing, the same expectations, the same thrust. And it happens to varying degrees. But there are those who I thought myself were more successful than others. And when I interpret the Bible myself, not many of them came very, very close. But again, some others.
Okay, so, yeah, I think I'll, if you don't mind, that so that we can get the others.
Sure.
You've put a lot of ideas on the table.
Yeah.
Right, we're all,
anyway.
We have so much to say. So if you don't mind, I'm going to stop you there and ask Reynold if you'll do your piece.
Anybody remember Mike Nichols and Elaine May?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mike Nichols we know because he's gone on to fame and glory as a director, but way back when some of us in the world were younger, they did a comedy team act, and I remember one time they were talking about the subway in New York City. This is to make distinction between society and community. And they said, yeah, the subway in New York City, lots of proximity to people there, but no relationship. I think society, when we talk about society, lots of people, but the relationships are very loose, like on the subway. When we talk about community, we're talking about people who are together in relationship. And when we add the word intentional, means that the relationship is pointing in a particular direction, whether it's to build up the country on socialist principles, as in the kibbutzim, whether it's a Christian community, whether it's a New Age community, whatever the community is. I want to talk about a different kind of community, and I want to talk about something a little bit more upbeat, which is unusual because as the academic in the crowd here, we academics make a profession of being critical. But maybe my way of being critical is I'll be positive to try to balance out the somewhat negative views of community we've heard. I myself have been in about 6 different communities, but most of them have been educational communities. or communities that have attempted to be more than just a kind of society. I mean, I think a big university, the big state universities where there are 30, like the University of Minnesota with 45,000 students versus, say, St. Olaf, is much more like a society. I mean, it's lots of different neighborhoods, but they're people doing their individual things. Now, the issue of individualism in our society is what I think makes communities so pressing and so important for us to think about. Scott Peck, in his book, A Different Drum, which is his book on community, I don't know if some of you have read that book, but there he says, given the habit of the American heart to be individualistic, a habit which Scott Peck, as well as Bella and others, feel is almost like a cancer in our society, this rugged individualism. The center doesn't really hold and people are sort of doing their own thing, sometimes, often, at the expense of the larger common concerns of our society and the planet. Well, Scott Peck says, if there's one thing that people in our society have to learn today is the importance of community, how to enter into it, how to create it, and how to sustain it and maintain it. And that's a primary skill. Well, I take that very seriously in an educational context, because education, as we've all learned it, is really very much an individualistic thing. We compete against each other, often on a bell-shaped curve where there's only so many A's and so many B's and so forth, and it's a zero-sum game. If you get an A, that's one less chance for me to get an A. You know, and so David and I are, you know, we're always competing for those good grades because there's only so many to go around. It's a win-lose kind of game. Not only that, but if I write a wonderful paper, the only person who sees it is my teacher in heaven, who seeth it in private, and no one else sees it. So it's always sort of from me to the teacher, from the teacher back to me. The feedback I get is also directly back to me. So it's this kind of vertical one-on-one situation. Now, I saw something that Socrates said that impressed me. He said one time, when people say, Socrates, you're such a wonderful teacher, Socrates replied, it's not I who teach, but the city. The concept that the entire Athenian culture of his time was the teacher and he was merely the sage of record. But the real teaching was going on around and through and under, you remember those theological terms. It wasn't just in Socrates. The example I want to share then briefly is the example of a class which I created called Literature of Wisdom, and it was created to develop learning in community, where we would learn from each other. The analogy was the potluck image, that each of us would bring something to the table, and that the meal, this kind of intellectual feast that we had, would be based on all of our inputs, and not just from me, the teacher, individually, to these different students who were competing. I did that A, because I felt it's a better way to learn, but I did it B because I felt it's very important for us to live in an intentional, non-competitive, non-hierarchical manner, and that was a learning that would transcend the specific subject or my class. For example, in this class, the very first class, we all have to learn each other's names. So we spend about 20 minutes learning each other's names. And students say often that this is the only class in their entire undergraduate experience where they learn each other's names. And they consider it extremely important that they can talk to each other. Secondly, we sit in the round, not in desks where you see the backs of people, but we sit so that we can see each other and talk with each other. And there's really no front. I make a point of sitting in different parts of the classroom so that I'm not at the altar, you know, representing God, and as teachers do, in a way. Another thing is that we have group projects in this particular class. There are problems with group projects that you probably know about, which is what happens, like in communism, if one person does all the work and then three other people freeload on them. And that's a true problem. So the way we deal with that, and everyone agrees with this, by the way, is that whatever the group project is, each person must write a statement about what she did in that project, and then the other members of the project have to sign it. And each one does this, so there's a kind of a check and balance that there's no sort of freeloading on the group project. There are other things as well. I mean, all our, after each class, the students do an anonymous survey in which they say what they like best about it, what they like least about it, what they the most important learning they took away from that particular 3-hour weekly session, any question they had, and a general comment. And then one student, on a kind of jury duty basis, I do it the first time, will take all these anonymous comments and responses, tabulate them, and at the beginning of the next class, we'll report the outcomes. And if there are questions, or if there are concerns, or if there was something they didn't like, that will be taken up at that time. Now, all of you who've been students know that there are often surveys like that at the end of a term, but they don't profit you in the class where you are. In other words, that community doesn't profit by it. Perhaps the next group will if the teacher takes them to heart. So that was another kind of thing. The other things are that we always share our papers. So for example, and by the way, I do all the work that the students do, and the students get the feedback on me, on my work as well. So for example, one of the things we do in this particular Literature of Wisdom class is we write a letter to a younger person giving tips on living the good life. Dear so-and-so, and then tips on living the good life. The students make up copies for each other's student. These are handed out, three-ring punched, and then they're read in class. We all read them to each other. So there are things like this over and over again. The final exam typically takes place, you have to realize, this is a class in a school that's an evening school with no dormitories. So it's like a lidless pot. There's no community. And I know we're getting close to the end of my time, so I'll complete here. But the final is a potluck at my house. So it's a literal potluck where people bring things. And after we break bread together and have casserole together and all these things, then the students read their final examinations to each other. Okay, and at the end, at the very end of that, we stand in a circle, and this has become traditional now. We have a kind of a farewell ceremony, and people say whatever we want, and then we pass the kind of squeeze, you know, what comes around goes around, and you feel it coming back. And typically, at the end of this session, you know, it doesn't sound like much to talk about it here, but people cry. People cry, and they talk about this as something that wasn't school, that was something special. And we're having now, we've done this particular class for 7 times, and the students called me up and said, can't we have a reunion? So what they want to have is from these 150 students over 7 classes, is that there will now be a reunion, and there's different students who are getting together to put together a committee so that it's sort of like Holden Village. There are different people coming through all the time, but they want to get together with the people that they haven't met yet so that this community can be, as it were, layered one on top of each other. People have become friends out of this. They ask, what class are you going to take next time so I can be in a class with you? People get lists with their names and phone numbers and things like that. Dates have come out of that. People have started going with each other. And I consider that a successful class. Now you may ask what they learn. I can tell you that the quality of the actual learning is incredible. And what people, the product, the writing, the quality of the writing is incredible. And I ask the students, why do you work so hard? Why is the product so good? And they say, because it's not just for you, it's for all of my friends in this class, and I want to do good work for everyone. So this is just my feeling, is that it's important to create situations where we learn from each other and we reinforce each other. And it's my way of attempting, as a teacher, to put into practice my understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ in my day-to-day life, so that there's not a separation, that church is what I do on Sunday, and what I do during the week is something else. And it's not just words where I say, you know, begin with a prayer and close with amen, but that I put it into practice in ways which are realistic, so that the students leave my class and we all hug, and it's good. So that's what I wanted to say.
Thanks, Rhonda. Emily?
It's kind of funny to be the one to talk about this because there are people in this room who lived at Holden longer, There are people who've been here in the past and people who are going to be here longer, and I think that probably every person who could talk about Holden would talk about something very different than I might. So I'm hoping everyone will jump in with comments when I'm done. When David asked me to do this, I was sort of surprised into saying yes. It was right after breakfast and I hadn't really thought through my day yet. So I just had a few things as I was thinking about Holden and my experience here. I've been here since last July, and I had been here the summer before that for 4 weeks. So I'm coming up on a year, and I think that it's been a very good year. I've enjoyed it a lot. It's been a good experience on the whole for me. Some of the things as I was thinking about it today and thinking about Holden and what it's meant to me and how I feel about the community here is that for those, I don't know how much people know about winter community, where there were probably 65 or 70 of us who lived here through the winter this year. And during the winter, the community has people come in, but it's a more, you know, like a retreat group will come in for a very specific amount of time, or smaller groups that come in for shorter time periods. So it's much different in feel than the summer, where we have a lot of turnover happening all the time, both among staff and among our guests. So it's kind of a different experience. But some of the things I got out of living here for a year were that, first of all, I think that Holden differs from some of the community, well, from what Anne and Frank talked about anyway, because it's a community that we all know is going to be short-term. The people who stay the very longest only stay 5 years, and that's only the director. Most of us stay 1 year or 3 weeks. Actually, the majority of people are only here 3 or 4 weeks and may come back summer after summer, but we haven't made sort of a lifetime or lifelong commitment to this place and how this place runs. We may have individually, and we may support Holden in many ways for many years, but I think that that makes a difference in how we deal with difficulties and problems. I think that there are some issues that we simply don't go too far on because we know it takes too much energy and we're going to be gone in a year anyway, and it's all going to change next year because it's going to be all new people. And so in some ways we don't stick with some things in a long-term way, but I think we would if we thought we were going to live here for the next 20 years. We wouldn't put up with some things that we decide that, you know, I remember when we first got here, someone told my husband, the one thing about you got to know about Holden is you got to pick your battles, because otherwise you'll spend all your time working on issues. And I think that's true. The other thing that sort of was, I didn't really know what to expect about living here for a year. One of the things I was most surprised at is how hard we all work, just physical labor. There is a lot of work to do to keep a place like this functioning. And during the winter, we do a lot of sort of long-term, bigger projects. I was surprised at how many hours a day I worked, and how hard I worked, and how hard everybody else worked. I appreciated it a lot, but I didn't get as much time for, I don't know, my husband and I had to schedule an hour every day that we would be together no matter what, or we didn't see each other. Living in community takes a ton of energy. You've got 7 other people at the dinner table with you every meal. So it takes a lot of energy. You've got to give a lot, and all the time. And I enjoyed it more than I thought, and it was harder than I thought. So it kind of goes both ways. I think one of the things that was best about Holden for me was the daily worship and the weekly Eucharist. Even though I just now said we were so busy and that was hard, I think that coming together as a community every day, no matter what had happened in the course of that day, no matter what was going on in the community as a whole, what was difficult or hard, you worship together. Even if you didn't like the worship that night or you disagreed with how they did it, you were all there and you were all bringing yourselves to this place at the end of the day to be together and to sort of reaffirm your commitment spiritually and emotionally to this community. And that was a real powerful thing for me.
And I think that a lot of what I liked was two of the things I loved. There was a lot of joy for me in just day-to-day interaction and involvement with people. I think what I really liked was that I couldn't, you don't compartmentalize your life so much here. If your sink is leaking, you know the person who has to come fix it. And if they're really busy, you know that, and that it's going to be a problem and they aren't going to get there for a while. Or you know the person who's the electrician, or you know the person who turns the power back on if you're the one who finally puts it over the edge. You know that you're the one who's putting someone to work in the middle of the night. And so I think in that way, it feels like a real whole place for me. I felt really in touch with myself and the people around me. I also think it made it, you can't objectify people in their jobs because you don't only know them through their job. You know them from the dinner table, you know them from worship, you know them from playing together and having fun together. And you get to know a lot of things about people. And sometimes you know things you don't want to know and you wish you didn't have to know and you wish you just would never have to know. But you do because you're in community and you stick with it. And that was wonderful. Also the joy of living someplace where you make all your own fun. When you talked about the TV set, I may be controversial right here, but I think videos in the village are bad, except for this one. And then, because then you have to watch it together, but I don't think people should be able to go to their separate houses and watch videos. That's my one thing. But I do think that there's a real power to living someplace where you have to make your own entertainment, where you have to go find somebody to visit with or find somebody to play a game with, or if you want to have a party, you got to help plan it. If you want to have a dance, you have to help make it happen. And I think everybody in the community got involved with stuff in the course of the winter. You know, we want a coffee house, who's going to make the coffee, who's going to set it up. And it brings out all sorts of gifts that people would, you would never know these people had the gifts, except that we're making our own fun. So it's really, that part was really nice. And sort of finally the thing that I thought was good for me this year was that when hard things happen, and this goes with the compartmentalization, you don't really get to turn around and walk away. I think when you have difficulties at work, when you live out outside of a place like Holden, you go home at the end of the day and you can talk it through with people and choose not to deal with it, choose not to follow up, just say, well, that's my boss and I don't have to deal with him ever and who cares, or that's, you know, that's how she is. And that may be the conclusion you reach, but you reach it knowing that you're also going to continue to deal with this person on a personal level as well as a work level. Or if you're having trouble with someone on a personal level, whatever. There's a motivation that you don't have elsewhere to really stick with it, to really stay with it until it's finished. And there's a lot of joy in that, and there's a lot of forgiveness happens, I think. And I'm sort of singing the glories of Holden, and I know people have very different experiences, and I know that there were times this year when I wouldn't have sounded this glowing. But I think that's part of it too, is that there are ups and downs. Just living with people and loving each other and learning how to do it every day, and that's been a gift. I think Holden's a real gift, even if. And if you're here shorter times, I think you get the same gifts, they're just compacted more. That's why I think people come back over and over. So.
Thanks, Emily. Yeah. And thanks all four of you for giving us a lot to chew on here. The rest of you, do you have questions that you'd like to raise or observations about other community experiences?
Yes. David, I would like to ask Emily if she is inclined to leave Holden and go to another community, intentional community, let it be that.
I think the one thing, I was going to say that earlier, I forgot to write that down. One of the things I think Holden has done for me and maybe does for other people too, it gives you your first taste of how good this can feel and also how hard it can be. And I think out of it I learned that there are things I really want to find in my life. I haven't seen intentional communities that look exactly like what I would want, but I do know that intentionally I'm going to build some things into my life having to do with worship with people that, you know, looking for ways to connect my worship with my work life, with the people I'm friends with, and making my life less compartmentalized. I'm not sure how to do it yet, but a lot of people from Holden moved to the Seattle area, and we all go to Central Lutheran. Keep in touch with each other, and I think, you know, out of that, I think there is a real desire to find community and to continue that. And I know there is for me. I know my husband and I would like to find a way to continue that, and maybe even in an intentional community type setting that we start putting together, but that's still out there somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
My question is Holden two communities? Is it a summer? And I think I'd just like to open that up for any thoughts that you, especially people who have been here through both, and may be able to add on that, or have been here for several years. Is there anything that can be said on that?
Who from the inside can help us with that?
I'd like to say just a
minute. Sure.
Just that I know when I came here my first summer, I had that sense too, that there was a separation between the two. I think that gets less as the summer goes on. I think that coming out of spending the winter together, there are natural affinities and relationships that have been built, and it takes a while for those to get spread out among more people. I don't think they're separate communities. I think that I know myself, at the end of the winter, I'm really ready to see new faces. But we're sort of in habits of relationship with each other, and so I think it takes a little time to open up and spread out. And I guess ideally we wouldn't be two communities, and I hope, you know, that we're always trying not to be separate that way, that we're trying to continue to open out for new staff and guests. But I'm not sure we're always real successful.
Not all the communities that you described have people coming in and participating for a while. Does that put a special strain on those who are here during the few guest time and the many guests time? You know, on your own relationships as community members?
I'd like if some other community people talk.
Yeah, I think Emily makes really excellent points about the community and about our habits. And those habits, I think, become very strong because every moment of the day we are interacting with the people we live with in the winter, and everything is incredibly interdependent. If the copper basin somehow is too cold and the water's not running and electricity goes out and food is late for the table because the ovens go down, and we're all working together to try to make these things work. And I know in my head Tom Wimmer's running down to the hydro immediately, you know, with another team of people to support what's happening in the kitchen so we can have lunch within some sort of time. But the constant thinking about one another and how connected that we are in that way. Elizabeth coming by in the morning with morning kitchen support, what had been a daily, you know, wonder in my life this past year. And thinking and expecting her to show up every day. And she did.
Yeah, sure.
You know, that's an important thing. To I think our self-definition here changes a little bit. We become more in touch and understand how connected we are to one another. And those connections become, I think, pretty deeply ingrained in our habits. And so sometimes in the winter we'll have a big bunch of people, maybe 100 people or 70 people come into the village, and it'll feel real strange because we feel a little bit invaded. Our habits change and we're serving other people. And I think it's a natural frustration that goes on. And maybe today some of you saw the departure of one of our long-term community members, and the heartfelt sense of separation taking place there, and the real emotion that takes place there. And the summer brings a lot of changes like that. You know, one of the patterns, for instance, like I've been living over in Lodge 6 all year, and all of the winter community people who on a daily basis, several times a day, would either stop in my room, because my room was the first door on the other side of the door that opened, and I would see them and talk with them multiple times a day, and they had all left weeks ago. And I had all new people there, not knowing their patterns, and many more to try to relate to. And I think the interconnectedness there, you know, and the habits that we have change slowly, but they do change, like I said. And when new people come and transitions are made.
Go ahead, Dan.
Well, I was going to talk about another sort of participation at Holden, which is it's like the swallows, you know, who return. and I always find myself as human peculiar, but then I realized there are a lot of people like this. I'm listening to the Barneses last night saying goodbye. And, well, we came a lot of times as guests, and now we've been here several summers as volunteers. There's another kind of duration, which is discontinuous. And one of the things that I think that allows me to see is rather like, as Raymond Reynolds said about his class, this sort of intertwining of winter communities and summer communities and guests, because there are also some guests like that. I think immediately of the Runnings, you know, and those of you who have ever been here with them from Pasadena, that's just part of the summer when the Runnings come. one of the gifts that is to me is how that's a picture particularly of the church and the connections that we have with one another that are transcending of time and place. We are sometimes together in the same place, and we sometimes do the same thing at the same time. For me, that's been very important with my parents, and my brothers live a long way from me. And I know when I'm in worship on Sunday morning that if they aren't in worship at precisely the same time, they will be soon or recently were. You know? And that's a kind of community, which is very, it depends on our intentionality that we do it. It doesn't happen if we don't do that thing. And so for me, Holden is that in miniature and in miniature that is made more intense.
See, I didn't get this to finish saying what I want to say. The thing, and what Emily said, and he said, and I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Deanne.
To me, it's refreshing because I have never experienced this before. The diversity that shows itself to me in Vespers and the liturgy, to me, is invigorating and refreshing, and it's always growing. It's not constant. The focus is in the right place, the gospel. Instead of worrying about the vestments and how they're tied and if they're in the right way, I'm seeing freshness and growth, and I don't know what other adjective I can find. To me, it's wonderful. I see a unity that all these different things can come out in the liturgy and in the Vespers and in the Matins. You see, I see that unity, even though there are the differences. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. You see, to me, it's wonderful. I've never experienced this before.
I'm glad you're here.
I'm glad I'm here. I am.
And this does raise the question of how important religion or a theology or a common worship experience is to a community. many of the historical communities, of course, have been centered around a theology and a ritual. Is it possible for a good community to happen without a religious and worshiping and theological base?
I think so.
Reynold, you described one.
I think so. I mean, I think that probably if we use the word spiritual, or if we use the word meaningful, something that really touches the core of people, that will work out. But I think that those, just as in that final kind of circle I talked about, I think that ritual and worship invent themselves. I think we can't be without those things. So, and it's sort of a yes and no answer. I mean, I think the issue is always how to make something inclusive and at the same time have common definitions. And it's sort of the American problem, it's the e pluribus unum problem. And when we make the boundaries too wide, then it's almost like there's no community. Community, after all, means common walls, literally. A community, the literal meaning from the Latin, means a common set of walls which defines. In other words, it's a shared home. That's what community means. And so you have no walls, and I think that this framework gives a kind of a framework that's common and shared. But I don't know that it has to be a traditional liturgical community. It has to partake of the Holy Spirit in some way.
And you've been trying to get your oar in here.
Just to say that, I think there are lots of communities. Doubtless, I think I sound a little negative about my community in Israel, but it's just because I think that the community that most interests me, and there are others, and the reason I keep coming back to Holden, and the reason I feel that Holden, my experience here in 1974 was so formative, is because here I found the gathered community under the Word of God. I mean, this was the place where, and the way it was taught to me at that time that has never left me, is that the community is the assembled group on that day. That group that comes together that day, not yesterday or tomorrow, because they will be different. And they won't be different just because the bus came and went, but because today, somebody might have hurt me, but I need to forgive them today. And tomorrow, it'll take a different, things will be different. I will have grown. That person may be still mad at me. I mean, but things, the dynamic changes every single day, and the gospel is the only really true thing that goes through all that, and that we live under together in a sort of dynamic that's so spontaneous that every day is like another lit match, sort of, and yet we have this one continuity of living under the Word of God together. And that's what I keep coming back to, like a swallow, and I feel like the only real other model for that experience is a congregation, really. I've never found another expression in Israel or anywhere else that is as close to what I've experienced here at Holden than the congregation. And I kind of keep hoping to find that in my various congregations.
It seems to me that community, as I've experienced it through my life, exists in purpose and in some kind of a noble purpose, some higher purpose. So that I feel like I have a women's community around issues affecting women in Chicago. I have been part of a civil rights community working on civil rights issues over the years, and an anti-war community. And all of those do some kind of a sappy substitute for worship. We sing "We Shall Overcome" a lot, and you know, things like that. But I think what gives those three feelings, deep feelings of community in my life, which I still have and still resonate with those people, and of course they're overlapping in Chicago, is the sense of purpose and seriousness of purpose and the joy and fun and depth of life that it gives one to work on those purposes together, even though they're not religious. but there's a sort of moral lens that we all view our purpose through. And we are the poorer for not having each of those communities, for not having an underlying religious foundation, but that's life.
I think we've been going for an hour, and like all good forums, there's a lot more to say, and we all have a lot more to think about. And I want everyone to feel comfortable in going home and going to bed or off to anything else. If anyone does want to linger and converse with any of these people or yourselves, please feel free to do that. But I think we should bring the formalities to a halt tonight. And I thank you all for coming. I thank you for getting us started. So,
thank you.